From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And Robin, one of the few bright spots in the terrible story in Orlando has been the outpouring of support from people who just want to help those who've been affected. And today, Orlando's Mayor Buddy Dyer spoke about the outreach he's seeing to the LGBT community.
If there's anything at all that can come good out of this, it's the fact that we stand more united than ever and that we are more understanding of each other.
Well, Orange County, Florida Mayor Teresa Jacobs says about 5,000 people have given blood following the shooting and that the One Orlando Fund has received $2.5 million in donations. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us from Orlando. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
So Disney pledged $1 million for the One Orlando Fund. JetBlue pledged $100,000. But I understand you're seeing a lot of lower level fundraising going on as well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'll give you one example. I've been speaking with one survivor named Brett Rigas. He lost his boyfriend during the shooting, and he's struggling financially to pay for funeral arrangements. So he actually created a GoFundMe account online. It's got about $9,000 in it so far. The problem is that he can't access that money for several more days. So he's still trying to figure out how he's going to pay for his flight to Texas, where he needs to bring his boyfriend's dog to his boyfriend's family. So it's a real tragic situation. And we're also hearing about smaller gestures that could be quite meaningful to people. For example, people who worked at the bar who don't have jobs now. There's other members of the community, other bars that are trying to take them in, find them work. A real estate agent is trying to find jobs or find housing for them in other cities if they need to relocate so they can take those other jobs. So I think that in ways that are probably beneath the radar generally, people are trying to help out on a one-on-one basis.
And I know that you've spoken to another survivor, Jawan Drake. Tell us about him.
Jawan Drake, yeah, I mean, he is a like so many of these, just such a harrowing story. He managed to escape when the gunman was reloading, and then he actually saw bodies being taken out by the police and went over and looked at their faces to find out if any of them were his friends. And he's, as one could imagine, traumatized by the situation. He's not going back to his job. He's a chef. He just says he can't work right now. And the other thing he's dealing with is something far more personal. His parents don't approve of homosexuality. His father didn't know he was gay, but his parents did check in on him. Here's how that went.
She was just like, praise God. And I was like, right. Yeah. She's like, I love you, and then that's it. My dad called me too. And he's like, why was I there? He doesn't, he doesn't know. He's like, why am I at a gay club?
What did you tell him?
I just told him I was there with a friend from work.
Wow. So even now, after this tragedy, a very difficult conversation between Jawan and his parents.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And it also speaks to his need for support from friends. Unfortunately, some of those friends are not alive. He does have friends who did survive like him and are also going through many of the same things. So they're coming together and just trying to figure out what to do next. And that's the one thing that strikes me is that there's some confusion, it seems like, among many of these people I'm talking to about, like, what are they supposed to do? How do you go about your life from here?
Jason, you've been there for a few days now. What are some of the other things that you've seen or people that you've spoken to or moments that are sticking with you as Orlando tries to recover from this tragedy?
Well, I think in the early hours, one of the things that really struck me was that people who were in this sub-community that was the club goers who went to Pulse, I mean, they were in constant contact with one another, communicating about whether their friends were alive or dead. In some cases, there was some confusion because many of these people went by nicknames, and online their names were not the same as those that were on the list that was released to the public. And so people were trying to find out, oh, wait, who is that person? Is that our friend? Is that our friend Zeus? And I was actually with someone when she connected the dots through another friend. Oh, that was Zeus, a friend of hers who died at the club.
That's Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal reporting from Orlando. Jason, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It has been a devastating few days in Orlando. The Voice star Christina Grimmie shot dead Friday night, the slaughter at the Pulse nightclub Sunday morning, and today, a toddler snatched by an alligator at a lake at Disney World. How are Floridians handling this? Let's ask Carl Hyacin. In satirical novels like Star Island and in columns like Still Chasing the Crazy Side of Florida in the Miami Herald, he satirized the state he loves. Carl, what a devastating week.
Yeah, I mean, you have three absolutely sickening headlines out of Orlando. At least two of the events say more about American culture than anything else. But, yeah, it's just, there's obviously nothing funny, and it's just heartbreaking.
Well, Carl Hyacin, you and your pal Dave Barry, in fact, you quote him in this column, he'll tell you the same thing. The sheer weight and volume of weirdness is unique to Florida. All the way to the panhandle. But there, you also have a deep love of this state. Speak to that.
Well, I mean, I was born and raised here, and my family's here, and my kids and my grandkids, and my dad and my grandfather were from here, and this is a place I'm loyal to. It's changed dramatically. I mean, when I was born, I think the population was about 5.5 million people. Now we've got 20 million people here, and we're trying to shoehorn as many more as possible. You're going to have collision of cultures. You're going to have the weirdness that Dave and I have been writing about. But in terms of the violence, that's something that certainly increased with the easy availability of assault rifles. The incident with Christina Grimmie, you have just, you know, a whack job with a pistol. How many of those stories have we read from all over the country? This is the age we live in. Yeah. It's not Malcolm X, and it's not Martin Luther King, and it's not Bobby Kennedy. We're now stalking people we just see on TV. And that's an American phenomenon.
Well, you're in Central Florida. What's the conversation about, you know, these several days in Orlando?
Well, everybody you meet is just shaking their heads. I mean, and they're ashen-faced, and you're getting, you know, you get calls from your friends who live other places, and they ask the same question, what's going on with Florida? And, you know, the only response you can give, it's the same thing that's going on in the rest of the country. We just sometimes do it bigger and worse. One of the fears that I think a lot of Floridians live with is the idea that because of the amusement park central, you know, of Disney, you have Universal, and these things, that you really worry about them as obviously a terrorist target. There's been some reporting the shooter at the nightclub actually scoped out, you know, a Disney property. And
that worries you.
Yeah, yeah.
Carl Hyacin, you in the past have taken pieces of truth of Florida and spun them into these dark comic novels. I remember one about, it was, I think it was after Hurricane Andrew, which was just horrific. And police were telling people to stay out of South Florida because people were, instead of going to Disney World, they were going to look at Hurricane Andrew.
Yeah, the tourists were actually coming down to videotape the hurricane wreckage and the people, the homeless people left homeless and the devastation. I mean, we had people with video cameras coming, driving from Orlando to Miami because they didn't want to miss it, like it was one of our attractions. Yeah, no, that kind of stuff. When you're in the business of writing satire, I mean, you're sort of obligated to include it in the novels and work. Something, the scale of this violence and just the despair that you feel, there's no way to work it into any kind of palatable fiction. You can't do it, obviously. There is plenty of material and rich material if you're writing about the politicians who show up after the bloodbath, the same politicians who take a lot of money from the NRA and people like Marco Rubio who voted against a bill that would have prevented people on the terror watch list from buying automatic weapons. He flew all the way back to Washington to vote that bill down. And I wouldn't have helped in this case because this guy wasn't even on the terror watch list.
Anymore, he had been.
No, he wasn't. But he'd been investigated. If he had been on the watch list, that's the irony. He'd still be able to buy legally an AR-15 in the state of Florida. Those guys are easy to put in a novel.
And into this horrific week of gun violence, suddenly nature rears up, and an alligator and a two-year-old.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking.
It is. And it's the final sick twist this week. It's a very rare thing, by the way, to have happen. We've got alligators everywhere in Florida. Very, very few attacks. But this is the conflict when you cram 20 million people into a place that has these and the gators have nowhere to go, so of course they're going to show up at lakes at Disney World. You can't keep them out, especially this is the kind of the mating season. They travel around all over the place. Usually in these attacks, Robin, somebody's been feeding. Some nitwits have been feeding the gators, so they get acclimated, and they're looking to humans for food. And every condo complex has got some moron who insists on feeding, you know, fried chicken to the gator in the canal. Mm. And that means that the next thing that happens is the dogs start disappearing. They do not stalk human beings, but this was a little toddler, and he was, you know, wrong place, wrong time.
And a Florida and an Orlando on edge.
It's a very, you know, sickening trifecta, you know, of stories.
Carl Hyacin, one of the voices of Florida, reflecting on the past few days. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you, and hopefully next time we can be talking about something a little more entertaining than this.
The Orlando shooter used an assault rifle very similar to the one used in Newtown, Connecticut in the 2012 rampage that killed 20 children and 6 adults. And 10 of the Newtown families have joined a lawsuit against Remington, which makes the military-style rifles. The plaintiffs have had an uphill battle. A 2005 law protects gun makers from liability. They say it's gun dealers who are responsible for gun sales. But there's a clause in that law, something called negligent entrustment, which allows for gun manufacturers to be held responsible if a gun is sold to a person who has a high risk of misusing it. And in a novel approach, the Newtown families say the very availability of the rifles is negligent entrustment because the guns are a weapon of war. The defendants, Remington and a wholesaler, want the case thrown out. Both sides have just one last chance to argue their side at a hearing next Monday. Meanwhile, Mark Barden is one of the plaintiffs. His 7-year-old son, Daniel, was killed at Sandy Hook, as was Nicole Hockley's 6-year-old son, Dylan. Both are co-founders of Sandy Hook Promise, which works to fight gun violence against kids. They're with us from Washington. Their gala is tonight. It'll be a somber one. And Nicole, Mark, I know years have passed. It doesn't matter. Let us say again, so sorry for the loss of your children.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Yeah. And we know from hearing from the Boston bombing survivors here in Boston that an event like Sundays in Orlando re-triggers things for people who've survived. Nicole, start with you. How are you doing?
Well, Sunday was an awful day for the country, but obviously as someone who has lost someone to gun violence, it was a horrible day for me that brought me right back to 1214 and knowing what the families must be feeling as they waited to find out about their loved ones. After that, though, after Sunday, I just got angry and have just really doubled down on my resolve with Sandy Hook Promise to prevent these tragedies from happening because they are preventable and people don't have to keep dying. It's completely unacceptable. And my heart grieves for Orlando and the community, but the rest of us need to act. We need to stop these things from happening.
And when people feel it's so intractable, I want to talk about what you both want to see happen. But Mark, you know, she thought of the family waiting. And we remember on that horrible day at Sandy Hook, at first it was thought that terribly a teacher had been shot in the leg. And then, you know, as the hours went by, and all of you were waiting to find out, I'm sure you were thinking about that, too.
Absolutely. And what an interminable wait that is, waiting to determine the fate of your child or your loved one. It's an unconscionable fact that we have to continue to live through this. And as Nicole said, these horrific tragedies are so preventable.
What would you have done the day after the San Bernardino shooting? Congress voted against extending a ban or reenacting a ban on assault weapon sales. You stood with President Obama after the Senate defeated the background check amendment in 2013.
First of all, as most of the country thought, I thought as well, it was the low-hanging fruit. This was a law that had been in place already for decades. It was just about extending it to all sales and not just most sales, and I thought it was absolutely going to pass. And when it didn't, it was an eye-opening education for me. We knew that we had 90% of the United States was supporting that. So we started to look at that as an organization. How do you activate those people? How do you mobilize them? How do you organize them to be an effective voice in this if you have that much support? So that's what we've been doing with Sandy Hook Promise. We've been getting those folks engaged and involved and really kind of looking for sustainable solutions. You know, one of the things that that literally keeps me up at night when I think of what happened to our children, to my little Daniel and to Nicole's little Dylan, is what could we have done to prevent it before it happened? And that's what we're doing with Sandy Hook Promise. We're trying to find those intervals.
Well, but Nicole, it seems like, you know, in the case of the Sandy Hook shooting, the shooter was said to have mental health issues. In this case, we have a shooter in Orlando who had actually been on the watch list, and it's still legal for him to purchase guns. How do you untie that system?
Definitely, I think our country needs to deal with the issue of the terror watch list and the terror gap that exists. It's insanity. This is about protecting the majority of people. If you're on the terror watch list, then you should not have easy access to weapons. It's as simple as that. In terms of mental health and at-risk behaviors, there are so many warning signs and signals that are thrown off, especially in these planned events, which Orlando was a planned event. What happened at Sandy Hook was a planned event. People knew that something was going to happen. There were signs and signals put off by these shooters, but people don't know necessarily what they're seeing or hearing or reading and what to do with that information. And that's a big education for our country as well. This investigation is unfolding, and I feel confident in saying that as the investigation continues, more signs and signals will come to the surface. But we have seen reports of the shooter's ex-wife and domestic violence. We've seen reports from a coworker of the shooter talking about, again, violent outbursts and inappropriate access to different systems and firearms. And now the wife's reporting as well. And I feel certain that there will be other signs and signals that come up, whether it's stuff that the shooter put on social media or whether it's something that friends or family knew and did not correctly identify or deal with. But it's almost guaranteed.
Well, and Mark, we mentioned you, Nicole, and eight other Newtown families are in a lawsuit against gun makers. Make your case against the assault rifle.
In my personal opinion, this platform, the assault rifle, and it comes in different forms, but the platform is designed for military use, for use on the battlefield, to kill as many people as possible in as short amount of time as possible. And that's what it does, and it does that well. And we see this over and over again. When somebody is intent on perpetrating an act of mass murder, that is the tool that they use for that, because that's what it was designed to do. My personal opinion is that there's no practical application in civilized society for that kind of firepower.
Nicole, you wrote a heartbreaking piece, a letter to the mom I used to be, and talked about, you know, how you just, you know, your life changes. What would you want to share with people just coming to grips with their own losses in Orlando? How do you get through this?
Well, every loss is unique. And there is no common journey for everyone. It's a very individual experience. For myself, as a mother to a son no longer here and a son who is still living and thriving, I just do the best that I can to honor my child that died and protect my child that survived. But it's every day is difficult and has its own challenges, and the future is unknown. You know, I'm not the same person that I was before what happened at Sandy Hook. I'll never be that person again. I'm still figuring out who I am right now and what my future might hold. But I'm just trying to be the best mom that I can be, the best friend I can be. And when I think about the families in Orlando and the journey that they might have ahead of them, the journey that they will have ahead of them. You know, navigating loss is impossible. You don't know how you're going to react until you're in that situation, sadly. There's no handbook on how to deal with this. There's no true cycle. You can bounce around every single emotion within, you know, multiple times every day. Anything can trigger you and bring you right back to where you were at the start. But, you know, people need to rely on their friends and their family and those that love them, and they need to be open to accepting that love because that's truly what can help you stand on the days when all you want to do is lay down.
Still.
Still.
Mark?
I would say the same. It's a daily process. You know, here we are 3.5 years after we lost our children. And I would say within every couple of minutes, I'm reminded of something. I'm constantly thinking about my little Daniel, and it is a cycle. I miss him terribly. I miss him desperately. I was a stay-at-home dad. He was my little buddy. We were home together all the time. And it's this cycle of desperate longing that for me just kind of collapses. It devolves into pure rage of where I have no place to direct that. I guess that's where I kind of have to channel that into advocacy. But I am constantly aware now of these folks in Orlando who are going through this, who are beginning this journey. And what I would say to them is that there's no wrong way to go about this. Allow the rage. You may question your faith, and that's okay. You may be angry and have ugly thoughts of rage and revenge, and that's okay too. And just don't let anybody tell you there is any way to do this. You're not heading toward a day where you're going to say, okay, I'm okay now. You just have to learn how to manage it.
Yeah. That's Mark Barden. He lost his 7-year-old son, Daniel, in the Sandy Hook attacks of 2012. Nicole Hockley's 6-year-old Dylan was also killed. They are now the founders and managing directors of Sandy Hook Promise. Mark, Nicole, it's, you know, we always appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
Office workers in the U.S. spend about a quarter of their day on email. That's according to the job search website CareerBuilder. And now a number of companies are starting to ban email, arguing that all that time is not well spent. Kurt Nikisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review. He's been looking into this. Kurt, start with an example of a company that has banned email and what happened.
So one company is Atos, a French technology firm, not small at all. It is global. They have their North American headquarters in upstate New York. The CEO there, Thierry Breton, decided just a few years back to try to get to a zero email policy. They're not quite there yet. But he basically said email is this great tool, but because it's proliferated so much, he compares it to like environmental pollution that came after the Industrial Revolution. He feels like it's got to get cut back big time.
So what has happened as they've tried to cut it back big time at Atos?
So they've gotten it down to 40 emails per week per employee. So that's basically one per, you know, standard working hour. At least in, under the U.S.,
I would kill for 40 emails per week. What a lovely amount.
Yeah,
so low.
You may get that in a half a day, right?
Yeah.
Or even less. Yeah. So they've been able to do that. And what they did do is that they set up other ways for people to be able to talk about projects through like an internal social network at the company. So you can jump in anytime you want to look at what's going on with a project, to add information. You can see what other people have written, but you don't have like these you know, emails pinging you, you know, every few minutes with updates that you kind of feel obliged to read at that time.
So what about other kinds of electronic communication, though? Because email is not the only one that we use at the office that can bog us down.
Yeah, they would say that this doesn't bog you down as much because you're more strategic about when you use like this internal social network at Atos. You know, your boss maybe only needs to check in on a project once a week. And instead of sending an email, like, what's the update? And then you feel obliged to like send a big report back. They can actually just look in without actually talking to anybody. You've communicated, but the people who need to see something at different times can actually reference something without actually being part of a long email chain.
Kurt, this fits into the larger theme of worker productivity. And there's also some new research on how to avoid menial tasks that take up time but aren't important to your larger goals. What are the findings on that?
So like email, your job basically is not, you know, your job is not to delete emails. Your job is to get stuff done, to work with people, to take care of problems, to create new things. Email is a tool to get you there. So the same way that Atos has looked at email and said, let's get rid of like what's not working for us about email, you can do that with your own job. And you can say, what can I vote off the island? Like, what am I doing that I don't enjoy anymore? It has to get done, but it's actually kind of menial. And I want to move on to things that are more exciting more of the time. And there are strategies to do that.
Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. And I realized a couple minutes ago I said, a phrase that we use all the time, I would kill for, which, of course, in the wake of what's happened in Orlando, I wish I had picked different words there, but it just sort of rolls off the tongue because these are things we say all the time. Kurt, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure thing.
The World Health Organization said this week that there's no need to cancel or postpone the upcoming Rio Olympics over the Zika outbreak. The WHO says there's a very low risk of the virus spreading more rapidly around the globe as a result of the Olympics, and the only people who should plan to skip the games are pregnant women. Helen Branswell covers infectious diseases and public health for STAT, the National Health and Medicine publication, and our weekly partners. She's with us now. Hi, Helen.
Hi, Jeremy.
So what is the WHO saying about why they don't see any need to move, postpone, or cancel the games? Because there are many people who have said that they should be moved or canceled.
Well, first of all, moving is a non-starter. I mean, when you think about the size of an Olympic Games and what is needed to mount a successful Olympics, it really isn't something that you could move in the amount of time that is left between now and August. In terms of postponing, what they're saying essentially is this is not a situation in which you're trying to make sure that the horse stays in the barn. The horse is out of the barn and has been for a long time. Zika is spreading around the world really quite rapidly without the help of a mass gathering like the Olympics. Yesterday, Bruce Aylward, one of the WHO's point person for health emergencies, said currently about 20% of the world's population is living in places where Zika is spreading, and about 30% of global travel is in and out of those places. So this virus has the chance to move around every day at this point, and they really don't think the Olympics are going to make that much of a difference. Part of the reason for that is because the Olympics are in Brazil's winter, and traditionally they've seen a drop in spread of dengue virus at that time of year. Dengue is spread by the same mosquitoes as Zika, so the thinking is this is actually probably the safest time to have it in Brazil.
But what are they telling people who are at risk of getting bitten by mosquitoes, especially pregnant women? We mentioned that they're saying that they may need to stay away. But what about others who go and who may want to become pregnant down the road?
Well, in terms of individuals who are going to go to the Olympics, I mean, they're giving them the same advice that they would give anybody currently who's going to any places where Zika is spreading. Take the precautions you can take not to get bitten. So wear light-colored clothing, long sleeves, long trousers. Be aware that these are bugs that bite during the day, not nighttime biters. So don't just take your precautions in the evening. You need to wear a mosquito repellent that contains DEET. And because it's been shown that Zika can be sexually transmitted, people who go to the Olympics or anywhere where Zika is spreading who are thinking about starting a family need to give themselves a little breathing room between the time they spend in a place where Zika is spreading and the time they try to conceive. So they're recommending that if somebody hasn't had any symptoms, that they wait 8 weeks before trying to conceive. And if they have had symptoms of Zika, they wait 6 months.
And just in the few seconds we have left, what's the latest on Zika spreading to the U.S. and whether this is going to be a country where we have to worry about those sorts of things?
Well, you know, it is getting to be mosquito time, isn't it? And that is of concern. And everybody is worried about trying to be as prepared as possible. The CDC released a report yesterday talking about what they plan to do when the Zika mosquitoes are found in parts of the states and their rapid response plans.
That's Helen Branswell, who covers infectious diseases and public health for our partners at STAT, the National Health and Medicine publication. Helen, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Well, all this week we've been talking about science on the program and hearing from a different scientist in a different field each day. Today, chemistry. Lyndon Archer is director of chemical and biomolecular engineering at Cornell University and joins us. And Professor Archer, you research polymers and other materials that go into batteries. How does that impact people in their daily lives?
Well, so to understand that, one has to think about what a battery actually is. So a battery, one can think of as a miniature power plant that basically uses chemical energy stored up in materials to convert it into electricity. And many batteries in commercial use today can do that reversibly, and so they're termed rechargeable. It turns out that every battery one works with is comprised of these little units called cells. And the cells are made up of an anode, a negative electrode, a cathode, a positive electrode, and an electrolyte. To design batteries that outperform the ones we use today, for example, batteries that are non-flammable, can deliver more energy, requires innovative design of the materials in the cathode, anode, and electrolyte, and that's what we do.
So you're trying to figure out how to build the best battery possible.
Exactly.
And what are the main obstacles right now to figuring that out?
Well, it turns out they are multifold. I think the a typical battery has to perform a whole variety of functions, and it has to do those over an extended period of time, right? So for a typical electric vehicle, for example, one wants a battery that can charge and discharge something of order several thousand times. And if you think about that, it means that the chemistry that's going on in the closed environment of the cell has to be completely reversible over many, many years. And so designing materials that permits that reversibility requires a combination of insight from theoretical modeling, which we do, and also experiments to investigate new materials with new designs that can actually outperform materials in current use.
And in the course of your daily work, are you sitting there with different chemicals and different beakers and things like that, mixing them all together, trying to figure this out?
Well, it turns out that things are a little more advanced than that. So my group...
It's not just like it was in my high school chemistry class?
It's a little bit different. And in fact, in some ways, the difference underscores the difference perhaps between a chemical engineer and how a chemical engineer sees the world and a chemist. So in a short way, a chemical engineer basically does on a very large scale what a chemist does on a small scale. And so when one thinks through the material set that would make a better batteries, part of the chemical engineering mindset is to also think, is it scalable? And so the process by which we converge on material systems that are attractive is somewhat more sophisticated. So I'll give you a few examples of the things we care about. So most persons listening to your show will be familiar with the lithium-ion battery.
Yeah.
This has been the workhorse in cellular phones, now in automobiles, and people predict very soon in advanced robotics. What most persons don't know is that despite their complaints about these batteries, they're actually terrific little devices that operate often close to 90% of the theoretical performance limits set by the chemistry. And so to make a battery that's better than the ones we have today, it requires one to deviate from the current material set to design new materials. So you might have heard and your listeners might have seen dramatic TV footage of batteries catching fire. We want to stop that. We're also interested in batteries that go beyond the lithium battery, right? So lithium has a natural abundance that's of order 0.001% in the Earth's crust. In contrast, sodium has an abundance that's like 2%, a thousandfold higher, and aluminum, something of order 8%, right? So 4,000-fold higher. And we've been asking the question, you know, why are we limited to lithium? Can one envisage a battery format where we utilize things that are present in large amounts and all over the Earth? And so these practical needs drive the need for advanced materials technologies, and obviously that's where my group excels.
Why did you get into this field in the first place? You started out in Guyana.
Correct, yeah. So I grew up in Guyana, which is in South America, a very tiny country. I grew up very close to the mining sector. So in that country, the mining of bauxite, the mineral used for making aluminum, was a pretty important industry. So I grew up thinking that that's what I wanted to do. Went to USC, studied chemical engineering, and minored in polymer science. And the current state is basically a function of the excitement, the enjoyment I had in learning something completely new, chemical engineering. And so in some ways, it's been somewhat of a linear trajectory, even if, you know, one looks at the beginning state and the end state, and it looks quite unlikely.
That's Lyndon Archer, Director of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering at Cornell University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
And as we've reported, there is more tragic news from Orlando. How much can one city take? The 2-year-old boy who was snatched by an alligator at a man-made lake at a Walt Disney resort is now presumed dead. Here's Sheriff Jerry Demings earlier today.
It has been now about 15 hours since the child was taken into the water by the alligator. So we know that we are working on recovering the body of the child at this point.
The boy's family was there when the alligator grabbed the child, dragged him underwater. The child's father tried to fight the alligator off, no avail. Vicky Krogh, host of the Wildlife Blog, joins us. And Vicky, so sad. What do we know?
Oh, Robin, it's such a sad story. And searchers are now, as you said, still searching for the boy's body. There have been something like 50 people working in an all-out effort, initially looking for hoping against hope he was alive. They were searching the area, deploying boats and helicopters, sonar equipment, dive teams. But so far, no word that they've even recovered the body. We know that in the aftermath of the incident, 5 alligators were found in the waters there, the man-made Seven Seas Lagoon, and those animals have been euthanized, at least in part to check their stomach contents to see if they were involved.
And you can't help but think about the young boy who climbed into the gorilla exhibit in Cincinnati just a few weeks ago.
Yes, that little boy was rescued, but in the process, the male gorilla in the incident, Harambe, was shot and killed.
So how common is an alligator attack?
One fatal unprovoked attack in 2015 was the first since 2007, according to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. And according to Sheriff Demings, which we heard, in the 45 years that Disney's been open, there haven't been any alligator incidents there.
Well, this is what we're hearing. This is not frequent.
No, that's right. Florida and the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission say the likelihood of someone in Florida being seriously injured in an alligator attack is only 1 in 2.4 million. But alligators themselves are common. They're considered vital to the ecology of the wetlands there. And they're found in all 67 counties in Florida. Anyone who's visited Florida, you know you're told over and over by the residents that alligators can lurk in any body of fresh or brackish water. And that includes swimming pools and ponds at golf courses. According to Fish and Wildlife, since the 40s, there have been 23 fatalities due to alligator attacks. And since 1948, they say Florida has averaged about 5 unprovoked bites per year.
We heard from Carl Hyacin, do not feed alligators because then they start to see humans as connected with food. But how else can people stay safe?
There are a number of things that we should be aware of that they're active from dusk to dawn, so stay out of the water at night and be sure that you don't feed them. They'll begin to associate people with food.
It's illegal.
It's illegal to do that, illegal to feed them.
Okay. And there were no swimming signs posted at this lagoon, but even just waiting at the end, because alligators can come up on land.
They can walk on land and they're fast.
Vicky Krogh of the blog The Wildlife, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, staying with Orlando and with just the multiple tragedies there, we want to take a minute to remember another victim of the Orlando massacre, Eddie Sotomayor. He was 34, worked for Legendary Journeys in Florida. In the gay travel industry, he was a trailblazer. His boss, Al Ferguson, says Eddie wasn't afraid to stand out, speak up, to help gay Americans feel comfortable and safe when they travel. Just this year, he organized the first gay cruise to Cuba. Al told us a little bit more about the man everyone called Top Hat Eddie.
When he was dealing in some of these gay trips, there would be large, large crowds of people. And he got the idea to wear this silly black top hat. And it didn't matter if it was 95 degrees or it was 45 degrees. He would wear this top hat, and in a crowd, he would stand out, and everybody would know, oh, there's Eddie. And then Eddie morphed into Top Hat Eddie. And then in social media, it became hashtag Top Hat Eddie. And it became very popular for people all over the planet to start taking pictures of Eddie and his top hat. People wanted to be photographed with Top Hat Eddie. He loved meeting people. He loved experiencing new cultures. I remember vividly last summer when we launched the Cuba cruise. So many people, even in the gay community, were so negative about doing it because they were fearful. They were scared of going to Cuba. And Eddie calmly, over and over and over again, relayed people's fears in the gay community that they would be welcomed, that they would be safe, that they would enjoy it, And he would say over and over again, the best way for Cuba to understand gay America is for gay America to go there. And I just think that there's incredible irony to somebody that was so much about tearing walls down and expressing diversity in our communities, that he would be cut down in an action like this that's designed to make people afraid and scared and the exact opposite of everything that Eddie Sotomayor was.
Al Ferguson, owner of Legendary Journeys, remembering his co-worker and friend Eddie Sotomayor, who died in the Pulse nightclub shooting Sunday night. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.